Welcome back to The Frontier. Hopefully you haven't forgotten me. I'm the co-host, Rob Cernkovic, and I'm back with our host, James Rockwood. And today I'm super excited to have Mike Petro from Putnam. Mike's the portfolio manager for the Putnam BDC Income Fund. And he's a cool guy. We had dinner last night and told me a little bit about yourself. And sounds like you bought your first stock when you were 11. That's insane.
Well, that's right. And Rob, thanks for having me. It's really great to be here. So I'm a self-taught investor. I did buy my first stock was when I was 11 years old. It was Tide Communications, which is a local company in Connecticut where I grew up.
And, how'd you do?
Well, you know, at first I did great. I mean, it went up 10 times.
Yeah,
and nice. Then I lost everything because I failed to appreciate the impact of the 1984 deregulation of AT&T. But I was only 17 by that time that rolled around, so I give myself a little bit of a break.
So 10 times over 6 years.
Well, yeah, but then again, I lost everything. Like, that's the right. Important thing is that okay. I lost everything. Yeah.
And you were hooked from there.
Right. Yeah. And I just, this is before the internet, you know, in the 80s. So I would write along to the companies and I would say, recall them and say, could you send me your investor packet? And they would send you a 10K annual report. And I would just read that. And that's how I learned accounting, by looking at the 10K, reading every line. I once went to the library to look up the U.S. tax code, which is actually this thick, to understand some accounting treatments. But that's how I learned, is just by doing and reading the Wall Street Journal. I've read the Wall Street Journal every day since I was 13.
That's cool. And you're an engineer. So how did you end up at Putnam, and how did you end up in this space?
Yes, yeah, so I really like engineering. I spent 2 years as an electrical engineer, designing computers.
Yep.
In this little 5-person startup, and that was a lot of fun. But we knew it was never going to be, you know, a great company. So we were shutting it down in 99. And, you know, the tech bubble wasn't full flower at the time. And I saw an ad in the Boston Globe for a junior equity analyst to cover semiconductors. And I knew a lot about semiconductors because I designed with them. So I cold called the director of research like 25 times. And I eventually got through and, you know, to my luck, the lead analyst was an engineer himself, and he was looking for an engineer who understood technology. And so I ended up getting the job, and spent 2 years on the sell side and worked my way over to Putnam in 2002. And I've been there ever since.
That's cool. And so we were chatting last night. He hasn't mentioned that he's from Boston. So I can say he's wicked smart. he went to MIT and Cambridge and then Michigan for his master's. So it's been a roundabout journey for you, right?
Right. And, you know, I was in a PhD program at Michigan in signal processing, statistical signal processing, which is very mathematical. And I really like that too. I like a lot of things, but you know, you can't do it all, at least not all at the same time. And I just found myself always looking at the stock market. I was spending 25 hours a week looking at stocks. And, you know, I just decided I would not get my PhD. I would go back to engineering in a small company, and I would just continue investing in stocks. I started an investment club back in 1993 with a bunch of my MIT buddies. And we did really well over a 10-year period. And that kind of helped me get into the sell side, that record I had running an investment club.
That's cool. And so now you're running an ETF for BDCs. Can you tell us a little bit about BDCs? And then we'd probably love to know how you got fell in love with them and found a passion, you know, really understanding BDCs.
Well, BDCs are investment companies that provide capital to middle market businesses. And so then the question, well, what's a middle market business? And that's a company that's got maybe $10 million a year of EBITDA on the low side, on up to, let's say, $200 million per year of EBITDA on the high side. And so these are companies that aren't big enough to have access to the public markets, but they're also typically not startups. Like, they've been around and they're established businesses. You know, usually they have real cash flow and real markets and real business. So they're just what it says. They're in the middle. They're not too big and they're not too small. Typically, a BDC is going to have a higher proportion of its assets in first lien debt, which is the first in line to get paid back if something goes wrong. And then the question is, well, where do the BDCs get their capital from? Well, they'll raise equity, and then they'll probably take on some debt, but not a lot. I mean, they might be levered 1-to-1 or maybe a little bit more debt to equity. And by the law enabling BDCs, they have to stay under 2-to-1 times debt to equity. So they're not highly levered. And then like the familiar REIT model, they're oftentimes managed externally by a management firm who gets fees from the BDC, but they also have internal managed models as well.
And so how do those differ for our listeners from venture capital or sort of traditional private equity? Because it sounds like they invest in and provide capital to private businesses predominantly. So I'd love to get your take on that.
Right, that's right. So BDCs are, in fact, the largest segment of the private debt market. The private debt market is probably close to $1 trillion now, having had tremendous growth over the last dozen years. And BDCs, as I said, are typically going to be providing debt. They can provide equity, but they're not really venture capitalists. Mm-hmm. They sometimes work with venture capitalists to provide debt alongside of a venture investment. But again, you really need to think of them as being in the private debt market, not so much the private equity market. They will be partners to private equity very often. So if a private equity firm is doing a deal where they're acquiring a firm, you know, where do they get that leverage from to effectuate that deal? A lot of times it's from BDC. Hmm.
And then I think it's really interesting too, because they've been around, reading about them since the 80s. Mm-hmm. And I think as you've heard this massive shift recently in asset management to provide retail investors with access to private markets. Mm-hmm. Do you think BDCs have missed some of that opportunity or growth in the same, maybe not growth, but the attention or the spotlight that a lot of these other initiatives have had with people doing, you know, different types of equity? You've heard venture capital firms that are providing ability for retail investors to invest in. You've got the accredited investors with all the new funds kind of hitting the market. BDCs aren't something you hear about as much, I think, in that. But I'd love to get your take on that.
Yeah, I don't think they've been missing the growth. BDCs have been on a very strong growth trajectory over the last 15 years. And even in the last, you know, 6 or 9 months, when the market's been kind of choppy, especially for small cap stocks, BDCs have been able to raise equity. I mean, Ares Capital, which is the largest public BDC, they've raised over $400 million in the last 6 months alone. So the markets are open for BDCs and they are participating in that growth. But I think you're 100% right when you say that people don't really know what they are.
Yeah.
And again, they are the largest single component of private debt, but people don't know about them. And I think that's because they aren't in any stock indices. And, you know, so people don't have to pay attention to them. And there's an entire side discussion we could have if you want to go into about why that's true, about why they're not in the indices.
Yeah, I'd love to get your take on that, because if you know somebody's interested in learning about them, like how do you sure. find out about them? How do you track performance? Like how does that work?
Well, there is a specialty BDC index, the Standard & Poor's BDC index. That's in the fund that I run, the Putnam BDC Income ETF. We're trying to beat that index. So there is a specialty index of BDCs. But what I say, they're not in the broad indices. They're not like in the Russell 2000 value, not in the S&P 500, even though they would qualify from the trading liquidity and from the market cap perspectives. And the reason is because there's this sort of esoteric SEC rule, which talks about how funds have to account for their fees. And so our ETF is a 1940 Act fund. It's organized under the 40 Act. And BDCs happen to be also organized under the 40 Act. And the SEC rule says that if a 40 Act fund acquires another 40 Act fund, then the acquirer, that would be Putnam's fund in this case, has to treat the underlying BDC's fees and expenses as if they were our own.
Okay.
So, which doesn't really make any sense. I would say, like, hey, if you owned, if a mutual fund owns Apple stock, do you think like Tim Cook's salary should be counted as part of the fees that the mutual fund gets? I don't think so. Like, honestly, I could design an Apple computer. I really could. But I don't have any expertise in making loans to middle market companies.
Yeah, that I hear you. That totally makes sense. And do you think, too, like the lesser known or the lack of spotlight comes from a byproduct of like the businesses that they're investing in? Because it's, you know, it's that middle market, right? You really mm-hmm. talked about those mid-sized companies, those are 10 plus million of EBITDA. Businesses are obviously successful. They're not going to be the businesses you're going to know and hear a ton about, like a Pepsi or any of these kind of large drug businesses or things like that. Do you think that's part of the reason why they've missed some of this spotlight?
Yeah, I think so. And you know, you're right. These are not companies that most people, or even I, would have heard about a lot of times. And also, they're not able to access public markets. That's part of the reason why BDCs mm-hmm. get strong spreads, because these are companies that can't access public markets. So they're not well-known businesses.
And part of part of what's important is educating folks and educating advisors on when to position BDCs mm-hmm. and when it makes sense for their clients. Like, who would be an ideal profile mm-hmm. of somebody investing in a BDC?
Yeah, I mean, anybody who's looking for high current income should be taking a look at BDCs. They have dividend yields over the long term that are in the 8 to 10% range.
Okay.
Right now, they're actually in the 10 to 11% range. And normally, you would look at a dividend yield of 10% and say, like the popular stock market wisdom is like that would be telling you something that, well, gosh, if it's earning 10%, then clearly there's something about to happen that's not going to be good. But that's not the case. With BDCs, they're structurally designed to provide that yield. And a big reason they can get that is because of their RIC structure. They don't pay taxes at the corporate level. Now, just like REITs. And so part of the bargain, though, is that they have to pass out all of their income as dividends to investors every year. So they have basically 100% payout ratio. And that's how they get those dividends. Now, you do have to be cognizant that these are equities. So even though they might fill the function of an income product by generating that income consistently, you do have to keep in mind their stocks and they can go up and down. And so I would not tell somebody like, hey, oh, I'm gonna buy my first house and I've got my down payment. And I'm going to be shopping for the next 3 months. I think I could put it in this BDC to get a little extra yield. Like, I would not do that. Stocks go up, stocks go down. So you need to have a bit of a time horizon and be able to tolerate some volatility in the principal. I mean, they go down, they go up. They're going to give you that dividend. So you don't want to think of this as a money market fund. You want to have a little longer time horizon and think about this as an equity that produces a very good dividend yield.
And in a portfolio, how do you think that would fit? Like, would it be a satellite position to support an equity sleeve? Is it something to accommodate or sorry to complement fixed income? How should advisors, when they're kind of thinking about where would I want to put a BDC in a portfolio, think about it?
I think the most direct comparison would be to high yield funds.
Yep.
High yield funds are not investment grade assets, and BDCs are not investing in investment grade assets either. They're investing in smaller companies, typically would be rated in the B's, single B. They're not investment grade. So that there's a very strong comparison there. Mm-hmm. Now, high yield funds typically are investing in larger companies than BDCs are, but I think that's probably the closest comparison. So yeah, you would use it, I think, to satisfy some of the income requirements that you have for the portfolio, keeping in mind that they are equities, so they would be a little more volatile, like high yield funds are.
And then do you see them being, when you're thinking about access, typically, when you think about access to private markets, you think it's not correlated to public stocks. It's a big advantage of why you might want to look into private market exposure. For BDCs, do they have that same sort of correlation or lack of correlation that mm-hmm. private markets tend to have? Can you walk through a little bit of that?
As you would expect, they're kind of halfway between.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the largest correlation in terms of the equity market would be with the, let's say, mid cap stocks like the Russell 2500.
Yep.
They're going to be fairly highly correlated with mortgage REITs, let's say, because they have a similar kind of income profile. They're only about 50% correlated with, or 50 or 60% correlated with the broader stock market. They're not particularly correlated with investment grade. So I think you do get some diversification from a portfolio perspective, diversification benefits. But again, they are mark to market, so to speak, every day because they trade, right?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's something where inherently, these SMBs may or may not, their actual true performance of that individual business that they're investing in may or may not have, true equity exposure in the same way. But when you're falling onto the market, you're part of the market, mm-hmm. You have that sort of proximity effect as well that's kind of happening there. So that's a really interesting aspect to kind of how they work.
We were chatting over dinner, like it's kind of interesting how the profile of a BDC has changed over the last 15 years. Is that a relevant like education topic that you're putting out and letting people know about?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think if you were looking at the BDC market 10 or 15 years ago,
yeah.
You know, I think many rational advisors would run screaming from the space because at the time BDCs were much smaller and businesses, and they were run by management firms that, let me think how to put this kindly, they were, let's say, better at raising assets than at making loans that were going to get paid back.
Yeah.
And they were much riskier assets. So they were in mezzanine loans, second lien loans. But the BDC space has really significantly evolved. So if you look today, instead of like these no-name small name advisors, you've got really big firms with a lot of experience. You've got names like KKR, mm-hmm. Goldman Sachs,
yeah.
Golub Capital, Sixth Street, Oaktree. These are all firms who have a wealth of experience, decades of experience. I mean, KKR basically founded, or one of the founders of the private equity market. So they understand how private businesses work. They know what they're doing. And they've got a lot of history. They have full-time workout teams. They've been doing this for decades. So they're really professionalized compared to where we were 10 or 15 years ago. That's number one. Number two is just the structure of the BDCs have changed and the way they invest. So if you go back to 2007, only about 40% of the average BDC's assets were in first lien loans. And again, those are the loans that get paid back first. The rest was in mezzanine, second lien, equity, things like that, riskier. You look today, BDCs on average across the public space have about 75% of their assets in first lien loans. So that's going to be way safer. You also look at the kind of companies they're investing in. Still in the middle market, but the definition of middle market has kind of grown, has expanded to the upside. So now if you look at especially the larger BDCs, they're much more weighted towards investing in the higher end of that middle market. And if you think about what happens in a downturn, a bigger company is going to have more resources, more product lines, you know, more access to capital. It's going to do better probably in a downturn. So the fact that they're in first lien loans, they're in larger companies, that augurs for better returns over the long term. So you've got that. And then on the liability side, that's been restructured as well. If you look at, I'm talking about the BDC's liabilities. You go back to 2008, there were only about 6% of the average BDC's balance sheet was funded from unsecured liabilities. The rest was from revolvers, let's say. And the problem with that is that a secured liability has all sorts of covenants and attachments and restrictions on it, notably marks to market. And so in 2008, when BDC's assets were getting marked down dramatically, I mean, after all, it was the great financial crisis, their availability of credit was similarly getting quite restricted. And that caused a lot of heartburn for the BDCs at that time. So what they did is they transitioned their balance sheets over time to term out some of this debt. So if there is any kind of trouble, BDCs don't have to be faced with having to pay back their liability.
Right.
So they really have pretty permanent capital.
Where did you see the growth? Like, where do you think the growth came from in how much sort of first lien debt that they've been able to secure? Like, have they been displacing commercial banking? Is it just that companies are more leveraged now? Like, how did you grow, or how did they grow that much in 10 years?
Well, the big bang was 2010, and that was the Dodd-Frank Act.
Right.
And the Dodd-Frank Act put restrictions on banks' ability to invest in leveraged loans. It did that by increasing the risk weighting for the banks. So it made the return on equity for those loans pretty unattractive. So banks have been exiting en masse from that space. And private debt, and also the BDCs as part of that, have been really scooping up share for the, you know, the last 14 years or 13 years because of that. And now I think actually in very recent times, the bank liquidity crisis we've had just in the last few months is just going to increase BDC share even more, because banks need to preserve capital because their deposits are fleeing.
Yeah. Right.
And, you know, first thing you do is try to get more deposits. Second thing you try to do is stop letting money go out in the form of making new loans. So you are seeing banks stop making new loans and BDCs are stepping into that breach. I've talked with numerous BDCs since then, and they're all saying the same thing. They're saying the phone is ringing off the hook. And so you're seeing better terms, better conditions, better spreads. and BDCs can kind of pick and choose which loans they want to underwrite now.
I think there's a really interesting qualitative aspect to what the BDCs are funding. That mid-market business, right, is such a core part of the economy.
Right.
And I think has a lot of sentimental value to retail investors as well, right? Mm-hmm. It's those SMBs. It's not the huge corps and, right. and this other kind of component. Do you have an example, and as advisors thinking about it, do you have any examples of, you know, companies, portfolio companies of these BDCs or some of the stories that they might be impacting to try to make it feel really real for an investor or an advisor who's thinking about BDCs? And how can I explain this in a way that allows me to articulate that value?
You mean like what kind of companies the BDCs are investing in?
Yeah.
Well, they would be like, for example, your local supermarket. If it's not, you know, Kroger,
yeah.
You know, a big company like that, or HEB, you know, it could be a local supermarket that, you know, has, you know, 20 stores or something like that. That could be a middle market company, for example.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. I think that has an opportunity as people think about it from a qualitative perspective. You know, investors want to know more and more, what's my money doing? Where is it? What's it doing? And I think being able to make that connection, especially to talk about a product like this, can allow somebody to take that and say, okay, I get it now. Like I'm supporting, you know, that local grocery store or
right.
you know.
Or like another hot area is sort of private equity has been rolling up like dentists.
Yeah.
And you know, those are going to populate some BDC portfolios.
That's really cool. So then you've got an interesting structure here where you have slowly priced products, like private companies are not priced every single day. Mm-hmm. But you have a product and a BDC that is.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the advantages and disadvantages that happen because of that inherent structure?
Sure. And you know, there are $60 billion in BDC public equity right now, which is not a lot, but it's growing. And there's probably a similar amount in private BDC equity. And so there's really you know, private BDCs and there are public BDCs. And they're kind of advantage and disadvantage to both. So the biggest differences would be revolve around trading liquidity and equity volatility. So on the trading liquidity side, if you have a private BDC, it's by definition doesn't trade. So the only way to cash out your investment is to sell the shares back to the BDC.
Yeah.
And they're going to do that on a monthly or quarterly basis. And they're going to transact that deal at net asset value, or NAV as they call it, which is the book value per share of the BDC. And that's fine. But the problem comes like, well, what if you want to transact intra-month or intra-quarter, and you can't. And the bigger deal is, what if everybody wants to get out at the same time you do? Because the BDCs, if you think about it, they're making loans.
Yeah.
And these loans might be 4, 5, 6 years in term. So you can't, a BDC can't just call up, you know, the grocery store and say, hey, I need my $50 million back. I mean, there's a schedule.
It's like classic run on a bank.
Classic run on the bank, right. And so, and as the banks found out, you yeah. know, deposits are not necessarily going to be around for the whole 7 years they assume. So BDCs, knowing this, you know, the private BDCs say, yes, we will exchange your shares for cash at NAV, but we have to put a limit, which is we can only, in the aggregate, redeem up to 5% of our shares in any given quarter, which is almost always fine. The problem is that a lot of times when you want liquidity is just the time when you can't get it. And so if a lot of other people want out, then the BDC private BDC is going to have to put a gate down and only give you a pro rata share of your investment back.
Right.
And this has happened to a few private BDCs. I think the most famous example is not a BDC. It's BREIT, Blackstone's REIT, which for the last 6 or 7 months has not been able to fulfill its redemption requests and has only been able to give about 30% of the requests back. So you can imagine that's probably a difficult client conversation RIA might have when he says to the client, gosh, I know you want your $1 million back. How about 300,000?
Right.
Now, BCRED, which is Blackstone's private BDC, they had 5.18% of their capital requested to be redeemed in Q4 last year. which is over the 5%, but they honored the full amount. So good for them. But I just point out that, you know, if you think about like all of the scary times we could have in the markets, I'm not sure that Q4 of 22 really ranks up there in the top 10. So if they got to 5.18%, like right to the edge, slightly over the edge in Q4 of 22, I don't know what to think about if we actually had like a recession maybe,
right,
or a crisis or a financial shock of some sort, what would happen then? Now, contrast that with public BDCs. Public BDCs, of course, trade every business day. Anytime you want to get your money out, you can just sell your shares on the exchange, which brings us to the other half, which is equity volatility. So as I said, a private BDC is going to transact at NAV. When you're in a public market, the price you get is whatever the market clearing price is at that exact moment. So it could be more or less, it could be worth more or less than you think it's worth. No guarantees. So publics are going to have a lot more equity volatility. Now, the private BDCs are basically going to trade at net asset value, which can go up or down, but it doesn't have the effect of changes in multiple that public markets have, because public markets tend to anticipate changes.
Right.
So that's sort of the trade-off. Thank you. That's sort of the trade-off, you know, between the publics and privates.
Yeah, and so you manage a BDC ETF. How do you structure? How do you pick BDCs? You know, what are you looking for?
So last night we figured out Mike has an alter ego.
Okay.
Columbo.
Ah, you're revealing some of my secrets. Well,
Columbo. So yeah, after this, he's flying back to Boston and he's going to meet with a bunch of BDCs, and Columbo has own unique way of.
I've been in the space for 15 years, so I think they know me. So maybe this is not really a secret, but you know, I got to go in there with a thesis. Generally, you know, again, I know all these management teams. I've talked to them multiple times. You know, I think I'm a pretty informed investor in this space
because you're an active manager.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. That's right. We're trying to win every day.
Yep.
And you know, I have a thesis perhaps or something I want to probe, which like maybe I want to understand, well, what'll happen when rates go down, or how are you set up for a weakening economy? And then I'm going to, you know, ask questions to sort of probe that. But I let the flow of the conversation kind of direct my questioning, and I'm pretty good at not getting off track. I'll let myself get redirected over here for a little while, but I'm always going to work my way back in to what I want to know. And then I get pushed over this way and then I come back in. So I'm always going to try to get the answers to my questions. And I think that's a better approach than just kind of just barnstorming in there and saying, hey, what's going on?
And you told me an interesting story too of it kind of combines the last things of like liquidity of the public market and how your fund works. Mm-hmm. And then some of the first person research and conversations you've had. Like, are you open to kind of telling
us
a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is a story about the oil one.
Yeah.
Right. Awesome. Yeah, so this is several years ago, and you know, oil was high. It was like 120 bucks a barrel. And there was a BDC that had about 12% of its assets invested in oil and gas companies. And oil was growing great, right? So everything was fine. But I was just worried about it. So I talked to him. I said, hey, guys, like, I know oil's great, but like, what happens if, you know, oil goes down? Like, are you guys all right? You know, are these guys gonna get paid back? And they said, Mike, don't worry about it. We talk to all those guys all the time, and we are good all the way down to $75 a barrel. And, you know, oil was 120. So I was like, oh, okay, great. All right. So then I filed that away, and this is in the summer. And then like as like September, October, November's rolling around, like oil's going down, it's going down, 80, 79, 78, 77, 76, 75, sell. Yeah, I could hit the sell button. And see, that's something that I could do because I knew that once oil got to 75, like they're gonna have a little bit of trouble. And they did have trouble, they did. And so they were right. But I was able to sell that BDC and redeploy those proceeds into a BDC that's better set up. So. Yeah. When you're in a private BDC, you are marrying the BDC. So you better be right. And the thing is, like, even if you were right, even if you picked a great BDC, you picked the best one, they have a great track record, great management team, everything's great. Is it the right BDC for 18 months from now, for 2 years from now? Mm-hmm. Like there are good companies, very good BDCs that in 2020, they had to issue stock below book because they just got caught offsides with the wrong balance sheet structure. Nobody anticipated the pandemic,
right,
and the almost depression we were going to have. And they had to sell stock below book. And this is a really good management team with a really good record. And that stock has never fully recovered. So even if you picked a great management team, like, as I like to say, sometimes the meteor hits your factory. You know, that's why I think there's value to diversification. So that we have anywhere between 15 to 25 holdings in our fund.
And does vintage matter? Like, is it like wine? Does it matter when you're kind of what year
it does? Is? That's a good comparison, actually. Yeah, it does matter. And
thank you.
And sort of like wine, like aging helps to a point.
Okay.
And so like the way the conditions are in the market when you're originating a loan matters, because this is, you know, making loans is a competitive business.
Sure.
And so if you look at like, 2021, late 20, early 2021, great time to be making loans. Right now is actually a good time to be making loans, as we talked about the banks being out of the mold. So spreads are wide, terms and conditions are great. But then you go forward to like 2022, you know, the economy is doing well, everybody's fat and happy, and money is free flowing, and, you know, there's a lot more capital lending. And so spreads are narrowing, and conditions and terms are weakening. And so if you have a lot of your loans written in 2022, that was maybe not a great year. So if we go forward 3-4, you know, 5 years from now, then you have to think about, well, gee, was that a, are we going to have problems? And another thing we'll look at is like, do you have a lot of your maturities maturing, a lot of your portfolio maturing in this year or maybe next year? Because if it's a 5-year loan, like no self-respecting CFO is going to wait until there's a month left to refinance that loan, because it puts them in a very bad bargaining position and they don't want to have a current asset on their balance sheet. So they tend to refinance at least a year in advance. So if you've got a lot of loans that are maturing in 2023, the question I'm asking is like, like why didn't your guys refinance? What's wrong with them?
Yeah.
So yes, vintage analysis is very important. Cool.
And then have you seen like a significant impact from obviously like the raising interest rates? Is that a boom? Is it a positive, negative for BDCs? How do you look at that?
Yeah, I mean, the conditions we're in right now are actually really good for BDCs. And when I say the conditions now, I mean a rising rate environment and an economy that is a little scary, but we're not actually in a recession. And the reason is because BDCs are generally asset sensitive. And so that means they have more floating rate assets than they do floating rate liabilities. So as rates go up, they tend to have higher profitability. And again, because they're passing out all their earnings to shareholders and dividends, you were seeing dividends go up. More than half of BDCs raised their dividends last quarter, for example. So you're seeing dividends go up because the rates are going up. Now, the other part of that is the economy. And it's really this kind of like hand-wringing, like, I don't know, are we gonna have a recession? Maybe, I'm worried. But we're actually not in a recession. That's really good because it keeps a lid on the general stock market. So the 10% dividend yield the BDCs give is actually looking pretty good. Like that's pretty attractive in an uncertain time. Now, if we do see a real recession, then I would expect BDCs to give back some of those gains because you're going to start worrying about the credit outcomes.
Is there anything else about BDCs that you think we haven't covered you'd like to add?
Yeah, I think there's one misconception about BDCs. That they're very risky on credit, and I think that maybe stems from the olden days when we talked about where BDCs were in fact riskier investments. But you know, as they've matured and rejiggered their portfolios, I think there's a lot less risk there than people think. And we actually have data that goes back from 2004, looking at BDC realized and unrealized losses. And if you were to annualize that, you would see that BDCs have an annualized loss rate that is actually very close to those of the broadly syndicated loan market, which would be like floating rate funds.
Mm-hmm.
It's right about the same. And it's actually significantly better than high yield funds. And there are a couple of reasons for this. First of all, if you look at the, why should high yield be worse off than BDCs? Because after all, high yield's investing in larger cap companies and you know they should have better outcomes. And they do. But the problem is that high yield funds really have no ability to turn around a company. BDCs, if something goes wrong, they can take the keys, and they do. They will own the companies when there's a default. But then they have workout teams, and they can get new management if it makes sense. They can inject additional capital if it makes sense. And they can turn that company around over the course of 3 or 4 years. I've seen many, many cases where a BDC has made lemonade out of lemons and you know, taken that company and turned around and recovered a significant part of their investment, and in some cases, significantly more than the original investment. So they've been able to take those failures and recover a lot of value. So I think that's something that people don't appreciate about BDCs.
Also a good qualitative aspect, again, when thinking about people's attachment to the local, you know, grocery chain or whatnot, you know, talk about, well, they're not, they can be turned around. They can, you know, they'll take a more active stance in it. It's not like they'll just write them out and they're always sort of gone. So that's awesome. That's a super cool note, I think, that advisors can use when talking to their clients about it.
Yeah, this has been fascinating. Like at dinner, I was just wanted to hear more, and today's been really good too. I appreciate you kind of rolling with us as we talked about, you know, you're buying your first stock and joking about Columbo, but it was really fascinating stuff. So on behalf of Mike Pietro and James, and I'm Rob Cernkovic, thanks, and we'll see you on the frontier.